want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
You can't find that on the radio. You'll turn to that station.
No, turn to the podcast, man. Radio is so yesterday. Was just an election. The world's not collapsing. I can't hear it. The Peter B. Collins Show, supported by great listeners, including Russ Archibald on the Big Island in Hawaii. And Russ, I'll be nearby. I'm going to spend a couple of weeks in Maui. And this will be one of our last podcast editions for a couple of weeks. I hope you'll give me a break. Also, my thanks to Raymond Welch, Mark Dennis, and Gillian Hurst. They're all voluntary subscribers to the Peter B. Collins Show. And if you're wealthy enough to do so, I don't want to take your unemployment money. You can support us, too. Just go to peterbcollins.com, and on the right-hand side of the homepage, there's the tab that says You Can Help. Our voluntary subscriptions via PayPal start as low as $5 a month. This is the second installment of our post-election analysis following the November 2nd midterm election. And in the second portion of this podcast, the effervescent and unflappable leader of Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter, will be with us. He does see some positives in the drubbing that Democrats took at the polls, including the departure of many blue dog Democrats. We'll talk to Tim about the future for progressives coming up here shortly. But first, we're joined by Jeffrey Feldman. He's an author and an academic and a blogger, too. His most recent book is Outright Barbarous, How the Violent Language of the Right Poisons American Democracy. He teaches at New York University, and his blog is frameshopisopen.com. And he also publishes at the Huffington Post. Jeffrey, it's good to talk with you again.
Hi, Peter. It's great to be back.
Well, it's good to talk with you, and it's been a long campaign season. Before I poison your mind with my point of view, open up here with your thoughts about the way the Democrats conducted themselves in this election year and any major gaffes or errors you think they made, language, framing, positioning, and strategery taking on the challenge of a midterm election where the sitting president's party typically does lose ground.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really important point that you raised about them typically losing ground. But I think the larger issue in terms of how the Democrats kind of face things, both in terms of language and concept, is that they began in the past 2 years with a very strong messaging approach to politics. And if we think back to the Obama campaign, it was, by some measure, an entirely message-driven campaign. It wasn't a whole lot of substance, either in the primaries or going forward. You know, I mean, everybody can repeat, without even thinking about it, what the main message of that campaign was, hope and change, and so forth. And what we saw from about the first 6 months after the inauguration, and I think really kind of deepening over the past year, is a switch completely away from that. It's almost as if from the top down, both at the White House and I think over at the DNC, the Democrats abandoned completely any interest in messaging, and they dove into a policy-driven approach to politics, where they stopped thinking that in order to persuade voters, you needed to present them with a compelling narrative, a big story, and link that up to what was going on in people's lives. And they started believing that the best way to convince voters to support you was to present them with a list of accomplishments that you had done in office, and then back it up with statistics, with metrics and so forth, saying, look, this is what we've done. This is the science showing how it's improved your lives. Support us because we're working hard. And I think that, ultimately that really failed. I mean, not to put too fine a spin on it, I think that, that's not how people get persuaded, particularly not in this age where every campaign is national, where every appeal to the public is media-driven and amplified. And given that the last election cycle had a lot to do with energy, however you want to describe it, you know, it was described either as enthusiasm on one hand or rage or anger or frustration on the other, driven by economic hardship, driven by frustration in the Democratic base, that things weren't turning out as they had hoped. Even as that emotion started to mount, the Democratic Party seemed to stick its nose deeper and deeper into this very wonkish, policy-driven approach to politics. So coming out of the election, I wonder to what extent, first of all, the Democrats in D.C. are aware of this, and to what extent they're able at this particular stage to pivot and turn things around and get back to a more language-narrative-driven approach to politics, which worked for them in the past.
Well, I definitely want to talk about the future, but let's deal with the immediate past and the results of the election here first. And I do agree with your point that the Obama team seemed to think that a lengthy list of accomplishments and the legislative successes from their point of view would be compelling enough to hold the base in place and attract enough of the independents who swung to Obama last time to, you know, at least avoid the serious kind of 60-seat loss that we're seeing in the House of Representatives. But I think that there were many miscalculations, and to me the most significant was that they thought the campaign ended in November of 2008. And just as we have an endless war underway, we have endless campaigning now. And the Republicans didn't stop, even though they took a significant loss and they were, you know, shut out of the White House and both houses of Congress. They are relentless, and they don't stop politicking just because the election is 2 years away. And so as Obama moved into post-partisanship, the Republicans moved into hyper-partisanship. And for whatever reasons, he failed to recognize the black eyes that they continued to give him as he continued to extend a hand, an olive branch, whatever metaphor you prefer. But, you know, the intractability of the Republican position was clear from when Judd Gregg declined his offer of a cabinet post and said, no, I would rather oppose you on your stimulus package than have to be in your cabinet and be silent about it. And that was, you know, very early in the jockeying. And yet, even after the election, Obama is still offering a post-partisan posture that really just makes him a target for takeaways, not for some sort of meaningful compromise.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Let me pick up one small part of that. The continuous campaign that you mentioned, the two outcomes of the election, I think, which are really interesting. Alan Grayson, a really outspoken progressive from Florida, who lost his campaign. And Michelle Bachmann, we all know who Michelle Bachmann is. Again, outspoken. I'm not saying that she has the same gravitas as as Grayson. But both, I think, are in a similar position. They both have managed to make themselves very well-known entities in the media. And they both take very strong ideological positions out there, you know, on the left and on the right. And Bachmann won. And you have to ask yourself, you know, what is the difference? You know, Alan Grayson, clearly a more competent person. You know, Michelle Bachmann making statements oftentimes that are not true. And I think that the big difference is the broader narrative that each one of those candidates had backing them from their party. From the Republicans, with Bachmann, no matter how crazy a statement she put out there, if she accused the White House or the Democrats of being un-American or being socialist, communist, whatever, backing her was this broad Republican narrative about Democrats abusing taxpayer money and growing big government, this big kind of drumbeat of conservative themes that they really spread out on the political landscape for, you know, 18 months to 2 years, arguably. And what did Grayson have backing him? Virtually nothing. I mean, every time that Grayson stood up and tried to make a compelling progressive argument, maybe got some airtime, it really ultimately dissipated because there was no broad Democratic Party narrative about the importance of having health care for everybody or about the necessity of investing in the public square. Nobody was out there making a big case, a big story. And so Grayson wilts in the election as his particular district gets overwhelmed by this energy and nothing to push back against it, and Bachman wins. And I think that's a really good case to make, because there's a lot of progressives out there who are saying, well, all we need to do is stand up and fight. And while I don't disagree with the importance of having backbone, I think backbone without that broader narrative to stand up with, it falls flat. And I think that's really the lesson coming out of this election for Democrats.
Well, and Jeffrey, the other thing that I think the Obama team just failed to recognize, either intentionally or not, is that context is so fleeting now, and it's created on a daily basis. And so as we're speaking here on Friday, the 5th of November, the big story is about Keith Olbermann being suspended from MSNBC. And this now kind of takes over in the way that the flap over NPR, Juan Williams, and Fox News dominated the news cycle for several days at the expense of much more significant issues. And my point is that the Obama team seemed to feel, A, that everybody knew that it was Bush and his policies that wrecked the economy. And so they didn't need to point that out. Well, I strongly disagree. And I also feel that the failure to investigate or prosecute wrongdoing under Bush and Cheney created this vacuum that the Republicans then stepped into and started bragging about. Oh, Cheney said, sure, I was a big fan of waterboarding. And now Bush admits in his book that he personally authorized the waterboarding of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 180 times. And the failure on the political level to fight the Republicans in a political way created this opportunity for them to take pot shots at a president who declared that he was looking forward and not backward. And this left the record blank when it came to the collusion between the Bush administration and Wall Street, the self-regulation of Wall Street, and many other domestic issues. And so when it came time to gird up and put on the armor for this campaign, the Democrats were already seriously wounded and still recovering from the fricking death panel arguments of August 2009.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, I think of this particular problem that you point out with the Obama administration is that of tinkering. I mean, they really believe that, you know, they imagine the problems that we have to be systemic, you know, that they are kind of foundational problems in the economy, and that they can go in and they can put all the problems together in a position paper, and with a group of experts around a table, they can tinker with these problems, and that the solution will bubble up through their kind of tinkering with the system, and then everybody will feel that things are better in their lives. They will feel that they had, you know, $35 more per paycheck, and they will associate that with government action, and then this positive energy will flow back through votes in November. And it's completely misguided. I think it stems from the fact that the Obama administration is a very kind of university academic driven administration and not necessarily a politically driven administration. At the same time, I think that the early part of the first, you know, 18 months was driven much by the personality of Rahm Emanuel. And it's unfortunate what happened there, in that what Emanuel was trying to do was not lead for the Obama administration, but he was trying to make sure that given his second chance, he didn't make, there were not the same mistakes that the Clinton administration made. And so there was all this kind of preemptive trying to eliminate any potential fight that they would have had, but what the Democrats have not seen. I want to kind of expand the argument here, because I don't think it's just the Obama administration. I think that it's also definitely the fault of the Senate, and definitely going on in the House. They fail to see the benefit to the party or to the legislative agenda of having many different fights going on at the same time on many different levels. So on the one hand, the president doesn't necessarily need to be pushing to prosecute the last administration, but why not have one flank of the House do that?
Sure.
Strongly for a public option, but why not support the House when they come up to do that? Or, you know, the president doesn't need to be pushing for, you know, a big public works or infrastructure program that can get people working right away rather than waiting for banks to lend money and that lag effect to reduce unemployment. but he doesn't need to kind of squash that those voices when they come up. So there's not just in the Obama administration a lack of this type of approach, but there's a real concern that if it even takes off, whether it be from the base outside of Washington or from various caucuses inside Washington, that would threaten this kind of systemic tinkering that they're doing. And at the end of the day, everything, you know, just gets blown to pieces by the Republican messaging effort, because the Republicans, given that they really don't believe in any positive outcomes from government, put all their eggs in the messaging basket and just, you know, make Obama the enemy and just keep on going after him. And it works brilliantly.
And by the way, he's black.
And by the way, he's black and Muslim and communist and whatever. I mean, just by the way, he spends $200 million a day to go on a trip to India. I mean, at a certain point in time, it doesn't even matter if these facts even come anywhere close to connecting with the ground, because once people are locked into this messaging machine, once people believe that the only way to really see the truth behind what's going on with liberals is to get it from, you know, from Limbaugh, or to get it from Hannity or O'Reilly or Beck, then, you know, facts become completely meaningless. What matters is the increasing extreme accusations that come out of the mouths of these people, and how sensationalist it is.
Jeffrey Feldman with us here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Jeffrey, I wrote a piece recently and posted it, and I read it on my podcast and posted it on my website, and it got cross-posted elsewhere. And it was my reaction to being characterized as the professional left and being called a whiner. And I note that President Obama called me and people like me whiners at a Connecticut fundraiser at the house of Richie Rich. And it's just amazing that and the president, in retrospect, at his post-election news conference, talked about being in the bubble and that things don't get through to him in the White House. But what's very clear is that, and I do put this at the feet of Rahm Emanuel, is that almost at every turn, this administration has turned on its base. And so by not even permitting John Conyers and others to advance a public option, a single-payer option, early in the health care debate, by squelching any dissent over the expansion of the war in Afghanistan, by sitting on liberals and telling us, just wait on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we're going to get around to it, and now this one, it may be dead, and only the courts can unravel that. But time after time, I have felt that this administration has wedged in the progressive base that gave Obama his start in Iowa and said, well, they have no place else to go, and kept reaching out to offer elements, for example, on climate change to the conservative, industry-driven Republicans, saying, well, we'll expand offshore drilling, and that was brilliant. We'll expand nuclear power plant loan guarantees. And all of this without getting anything back from the Republicans. And so I wrote this piece. It was 14 bullet points. I'll stop whining when. And basically when you deliver on the promises you made to progressives. And the Obama team seems completely oblivious as to why there was the so-called enthusiasm gap, and that many people, like that woman who spoke out to Obama in one of his meet and greets, said that she was tired of defending him. They really didn't get how much they had alienated their base.
Yeah, and I think that the broader issue here, in my mind, is what I call symbolic politics, because, what the Obama administration believes in very deeply, I think they believe this deep down in their bones, is that they were making the right decisions to fix what were deep structural problems in our economy, that they did what had to be done. It was just a great piece by in the New York Times, which was talking about, you know, the new chief of staff, Rouse, his mm-hmm. his view of what they did, you know, that they made decisions that were the right decisions, even full well knowing that perhaps they would not have been the most politically expedient. But what they lost sight of is that if people didn't feel change in their lives, people didn't feel progress in their lives, if they couldn't see something large and symbolic in front of them that the Obama administration had done, then they would not be able to register any of the other results in the political realm of all the work that the Obama administration had done. And it's, what is surprising to me is how much this translates on every single level. So what the progressives were kind of arguing for, and I join you in the frustration when they criticized the professional left, they argued for change that people could feel right away. So if you put a public option in the health care proposal, people see that you're arguing on behalf of folks who can't get health care. You know, why not do that? Because even if you cannot get that right away, people will see you arguing for them. And as a result of that, people will back your efforts and understand what you're trying to do. And then whatever systemic proposals you're trying to put forward that aren't as immediate, people will be more sympathetic towards that. That's why I think, if people don't recall it as much, but the auto industry bailout, I think that was probably the last kind of successful effort by the Obama administration, because it was an attempt to step into a major industry, to make change that would ultimately, hopefully, save jobs, that kept people in their work. I think in the initial part of the stimulus plan that kept teachers at work, kept firemen at work, police officers and so forth, I think that also was supported by people initially because they said, hey, here's the president stepping up for me right away. But the second they got lost in the financial fixes they were trying to do for the banking industry, when they got lost in the details of the health care bill, people stopped feeling this change in their lives, and when progressives spoke up against it, they were speaking on behalf of those folks, and I think at that point the president was just lost. Again, though, you know, this is, in many ways, it's the limits of a transactional politics approach that the Obama administration has taken. And, you know, what I mean by that is, you know, they look at the Congress, and they put all of the potential votes on a big piece of paper. They put them up on the wall in the West Wing, and they say, okay, these are the votes we have. What is possible given what we have? And they try to eliminate anything that will undercut that. That's the approach that they took. You know, that's Rahm Emanuel's legacy. What they could do is they could say, okay, these are the potential, you know, pressure points out there in the debate right now. If we push here on this, then we could get movement in the Congress. Sure, maybe we only have 150 votes going into this particular issue, but if we go after a public option and we really push hard, if we start talking about universal health care for everyone, that could free up more and more votes. We could rally the base and we can make something possible that previously was not possible. And I think that that's what progressives really wanted to see. That's what they thought they were going to see when Obama ran on hope and change. But what they got was this kind of old school, very conservative, very fear-filled transactional politics that was most concerned about losing control. They didn't want to give anything to progressives, definitely not bloggers, because they were afraid of losing control and then having those few votes that they had on their board slip away.
Jeffrey, I'm going to ask a series of questions here, but it's framed around why I supported Obama. Two reasons. One was that he was the clearest anti-war candidate of the crop of Democrats who surfaced by the end of 2007. And number two, it's because he wasn't a Clinton. And I was hoping to see a break from this Clinton-Bush dynasty situation. So first to the issue of war, it didn't come up at all in this campaign. And I fault the media more than the candidates. I do understand that, you know, a candidate looks at the polls and says, well, I can't win on the war because I'm hobbled by my president's expansion in Afghanistan, and we've got an unfinished situation in Iraq. And so candidates were prone to keep silent about it. But the media failed in raising the most significant foreign policy issue that we face, and one that was a huge factor in the midterm of 06 and in the presidential of 08. And so I think that that was a wholesale failure on the part of the media, and that we as the electorate were distracted into immigration and a lot of tit-for-tat about jobs and the economy that really didn't advance our understanding of the candidates or what the new majorities will do in the House and the Senate.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the kind of tit for tat that you talk about, and, you know, for in the absence of any serious debate about the war. I mean, for example, you know, the war supposedly ended in Iraq, and there was only, I think, one network that happened to have someone in place, and then there was the WikiLeaks controversy, mm-hmm. Which should have sparked a very serious debate in this country, but didn't. Again, I have to say that this kind of nonsense debate, that this is what we get when there is no serious attempt to control the debate and to keep it focused from one party. I think that we got the nonsense because that nonsense really benefited the opposition. In this case, if the country was going on and on about the so-called, in quotes, Ground Zero mosque, instead of seriously talking about rebuilding cities or getting people back to work, then that benefited the opposition. And I think that's true all the way down the line. So when you get a vacuum, you get an absence of any gravitas in our political debate when no one is in the Democratic Party is making an effort to run a national campaign. I think that, on the other hand, though, what you get with, particularly with the war issue, and I don't think it's just the war issue. I think the environment, in my mind, the absolute kind of vanishing of the environment or any serious talk about the environment in the midst of
right.
the largest environmental disaster in our nation's history
yeah.
was absolutely pathetic. But there you have the Democratic Party not believing that they had votes to pass those issues and so not wanting to talk about them because they didn't want to get hit from the left and then beat up from the right. I mean, it's an administration that has... And a party leadership in the Congress that has picked a particular approach to doing politics, which involves 100% doing backroom deals and not going out to the base and rallying people around issues that are based in principle and getting knocked around as a result. And if you talk to people in D.C. about this, you bring up the question of the importance of driving the narrative. What you get is, at this point, you get people saying, we don't have time to do that on the one hand, and we're not very good at that on the other hand.
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is that that's just not true. They've got plenty of time. There's a ton of experts out there, people who are biting at the bit, young people who are really engaged with social media, and who are willing to do this work and get out there and fight the fight. There's an entire network out there who sees itself now, up until today, I think, as a balance to the right-wing media. Growing in their popularity, their voices are becoming stronger and stronger every week, I think. So there's a real possibility out there for the Democrats, but they just lost their way in this particular cycle.
And Jeffrey, the other reference I made was that Obama was not a Clinton, and therefore I thought we'd see some different people populating his administration. I was dead wrong about that. With the exception of the holdover of Bush's last Secretary of Defense, it's all these Clinton reruns, including Hillary herself as Secretary of State. Now, once I accepted that reality, I thought, well, the one benefit could be that they'll prevent the repetition of the obvious mistakes made by Bill Clinton. And let me just enumerate two. First was the day one pronouncement that he was going to lift the ban on gays serving in the military. And we saw what it has produced an 18-year mess that is still not resolved. And the equivalent of that was Obama made the day one flourish announcement, I'm going to close Guantanamo. And like Clinton not checking with Sam Nunn, Obama didn't check with key Democratic leaders and didn't even have his own party fully in support of that pronouncement. Then the centerpiece of policy for both presidents was health care reform. In Clinton's case, it was driven by the polling out of Pennsylvania, where Harris Wofford, a one-term senator, an appointed senator who didn't even get elected in his own right, had made a big deal out of health care. And I certainly support health care reform, but on a cynical political level, you have to look at, the forces that it unleashes and the way they fight back. So Obama did the same two things. We had the day one pronouncement about Gitmo, and then the first 2 years were devoted to a single policy initiative on health care. And we saw how that played out in 1994. How could they not have taken steps to prevent the same result this time?
I think those are great points. I mean, in my mind, I never believed that there were two Democratic parties out there. I mean, I was convinced from the start that no matter which candidate we voted for, we were going to get the exact same party. And I think that the problem in particular with health care is that while the names changed, the staffers behind the scenes were probably roughly the same. People were probably pulling out the exact same, manila folders in order to get this started. When someone gives you a call and says, I want you to generate a health care bill, you probably have two options in Washington, D.C. in order to get language on paper. Number one is you call a lobbyist who supplies you with the industry's version of the bill that you should have. Or number two, you go to someone who worked on it before and they pull out the draft or the file they have on their computer and use that as a boilerplate to get moving. So I think they made the same mistakes because the same people in place were there to make those mistakes. And it's astounding, though, that there was no one there around to say to the Obama administration or say to Harry Reid or to Nancy Pelosi, look, rather than this massive kind of omnibus health care bill, which tries to accomplish everything in one go, why don't we put something small on the table and try to get it passed right away, something that affects people right away, a bill to build new public clinics, which will put people to work in all different states and get shiny new hospitals there, and maybe a bill, you know, to cover everybody up to the age of 26 on their parents' insurance and something about keeping people from getting kicked off for being sick, something reasonable like that. You know, none of these complicated ideas about exchanges and
yeah.
things which are ultimately impossible for even the most educated and informed voter to really grasp. But they decided that they, you know, I think what happened was after passing the stimulus bill, which was a lot of money, I think they thought they could do the big deed right away and that everyone would just come along. I don't think they suspected that the Republicans would say, look, given we're going to throw out the few ideas that we have left in our crusty old heads, and we're just going to make this all about hating on Obama. I don't think he really saw that, and I think that's where a certain naivete comes into play with the Obama administration. A lack of executive experience comes into play,
and a lack of direct hands-on presidential leadership. Because
yeah.
Obama waited 14 months till February of 2010. I'm sorry, to actually define his position on what he wanted in a health care bill, and he should have led that instead of letting Max Baucus and others who are conflicted at best, if not totally compromised, because of their links to the industries affected by this legislation. And so I see from the get-go that they really failed to manage the legislative process, and then they went into the recess in August of 2009 without a bill, and the Republicans just ran wild and created the fictional death panels and the socialism argument. And they never recovered from that.
Yeah, it is. I think that they went in with much worse than not having a good bill. I think that what they did, they gave to the Republicans, was an object lesson in what it is that makes Barack Obama afraid. And I think that what Barack Obama showed in that is he didn't want to put forward a bill because he didn't want to become the target. And I think what the Republicans took from that is that Obama is afraid to be the target. So if we make him the target, we will weaken him. And that has proven to be true just about every time. Every time someone like, you know, Sarah Palin or Newt Gingrich or anybody stands up and hits at the president, he does not hit back. He doesn't even send out a surrogate to hit back. And each time they do that, I think the public looks and says, well, if the leader of the party, if the leader of the Democrats is not even standing up and arguing when he is personally attacked, then why should we believe that the proposals that the Democratic Congress is putting forward is worthwhile? And I think that that's really, it's an important lesson to see, because there is a broad kind of big story issue that comes out of how the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress handled these legislative issues, that people took away stories about the Democratic Party that go far beyond just health care or banking or stimulus spending or the environment. They, they took away lessons about the moral character of the people who were leading the government, and those had a serious impact on what people were thinking when they went into the voting booth.
Jeffrey, I'm one of these people who is just aghast at the way this so-called Tea Party movement, which, you know, if you're objective and honest about it, represents somewhere between 2% and 5% of the electorate at best, was embraced by a group of billionaires and political consultants like Rossi here in California, who created the Tea Party Express. And this was magnified not only by Fox News, but by the mainstream media as well. The phony anger that surfaced at the town hall healthcare meetings in August of 2009 was propelled into broad and widespread anger among the electorate nationwide. And now the truth has caught up with the mythology, at least to some extent. And the Tea Party did have an impact, but well disproportionate to its actual numbers. And the Obama team failed to expose it as the billionaire-funded, pro-corporate effort that it truly is. And that failure, to me, is astounding, because it's not as if these guys were hiding.
think what happened here is that, you know, what the Tea Party managed to do, which is really amazing, because I have to kind of, you have to give them credit for some success in this election, so I'm just going to get that out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, if you look at, there's a great book by Malcolm Gladwell, I'm sure that all of your listeners have heard of it, called The Tipping Point, in which he kind of explains why it is that kind of little social moments become huge waves or trends. And I think that's what happened with the Tea Party, is that you had, you know, the disgruntled people on the far on the right, John Birch Society folks and so forth, and then this little spark, you know, Rick Santelli on CNBC complaining about people having to pay for their neighbors' mortgages and so forth, kind of a moment, kind of a huff and puff in a paper bag, and that was just enough to inspire people to go out and have these kind of meetups where all the crazies came out, and then that was enough to catch the eye of people like Jim DeMint, and get people saying, you know what, maybe there's something out there that if we just feed a little bit of money to this ragtag group, and we kind of tell them, call this if you need some Xeroxing, a little bit of organization, or a bus ride. And that was enough to give them the edge in this primary season, and then to get them some attention. And the second they won a few primaries, bam, they're on. They're all over the media, and they caught the eyes of, you know, these opportunists like Palin and Beck, and then they were off to the races. So, you know, I think that what was going on with the Obama administration and with the Democrats in Congress is that they were looking down their noses at this, and the reason they didn't see it coming is because they long ago had decided that a political base is only useful when you're trying to raise money in an election campaign, or you need some place to send out people to give a speech. They're not useful for generating this kind of momentum that can shift the political landscape. So shame on them for not seeing that, and I hope that they learn the lesson fast, because we are now in a time when politics more than ever will turn on a dime, when these types of moments will happen more and more often. They've been happening for a long time on the left, and the Obama administration has just been ignoring it. There's now tons of progressives who are signing up for new progressive organizations, who are frustrated, disgruntled, but they have not yet completely thrown the towel in on the Democratic Party. They are simply looking for an opportunity, a way to get their ideas into campaigns and be heard. And I think it's a chance for the establishment in Washington, if they're not too far gone, to nurture that and to see where it can take them.
Finally, Jeffrey, I was struck by the president's Wednesday news conference when reporters repeatedly asked him, is he going to change? Is he going to compromise? Does he get the message? Does he get it? Get it, get it. John Stewart made hay with that repeated comment from reporters. And the thing that I don't think the president gets is the very public determination by Mitch McConnell and his Republican colleagues to do everything they can to defeat Obama in 2012. That's their stated goal. They want him to fail, no matter what the price is that the nation pays as a result. And so I was struck by his conciliatory approach. Not that I wouldn't expect some of that language from a president whose party suffered a bad defeat the night before, but he refused to draw any boundaries. And on the question of will you support the Republican demand that all of Bush's tax cuts be extended, including those for the top 3%, the ultra-wealthy in this country, at a cost of $750 billion on that item alone, he basically just waffled. And it's like he put a big sign on his forehead that said, screw me. And you know, he's waiting for the Republicans to come. And he didn't say, well, I will support extending middle-class tax cuts and the investment tax cuts and even the estate tax, but when it comes to billionaires, I have a veto pen. And he did not draw any lines or put any limits whatsoever. And I just think that this is the harbinger of a weakened president who isn't willing to use the powers that he retains. He is relevant, to come back to the 94 comment from Bill Clinton, and yet he was undermining his relevancy in that news conference.
Absolutely he was. I thought that news conference was a huge blunder. I'm surprised that there was no one in the White House who took him aside and said, this conference is political theater. What do we want? to achieve? What do we want to accomplish out of this news conference? And instead, it seemed like they were sending him out to wear, you know, the haircloth shirt to say, mea culpa, I have failed the entire nation. I mean, if there's one request that I could put to the Obama administration, it's say, stop sending him out there to say, it's my fault, I take responsibility. I think it's great that we got a president, unlike the last one, who once in a while was willing to say, look, we made a mistake. But every single time, I'm tired of hearing that. I mean, what Obama really needed to see in that moment was that this is a chance to define what this election was about. And he didn't do that. He stood up and said this. He made it about him being the loser. And the Republicans were very much prepared for that Wednesday morning moment. They had long ago decided that no matter what the outcome of the election, even if they had not taken back the House, even if they had not put such a good show on in the Senate, they would have stood up and said, this election was on about a referendum on how bad the Obama administration is doing, about how the American people do not like the so-called super liberal agenda of the Obama administration, et cetera, et cetera. That was prearranged. They decided to make that statement long before any of the votes were cast. And the Obama administration did not see that moment as a chance to set the record straight, to say, look, you know, 30% of this country thinks that I wasn't even born here. I'm not entirely concerned about what those people think. So those 15%, you know, to the people who voted for us last time but didn't vote for us this time, look, you know, we still have a lot to do. I'm still here. I'm still going to fight for you, and so forth. I'm very surprised that he did that. But again, you know, I think I might be a little bit more optimistic than you are, Peter, because I think that you know, as fast as the Tea Party emerged and swept across the landscape, I do believe that the Obama administration can still wake up before it's too late. I believe that they can come to their senses, they can realize that they need to get back to doing what they did well when he ran for office, that they need to get a sincere message out there. They need to stop waffling on these watered-down legislations, and they need to really put some symbolic leadership out in front of the country, and I think once they get a little success doing that, they can turn themselves around. But
the other thing I would add to that, Jeffrey, and I agree with your points there, is that they need to exploit the divisions between the mainline corporate Republicans and the new Tea Party recruits, and they need to drive a wedge between Marco Rubio, who is a pretty magnetic figure with a powerful personal story to tell, fronting for very extreme politics, and they need to separate him and whatever, you know, he's able to generate in terms of charisma and political magnetism from the John Boehner, Mitch McConnell old line GOP, because if they are able to find common ground, and we're seeing right now Michelle Bachmann is jockeying for a leadership post. And how they play that on the Republican side is going to be very interesting, but more importantly, how the Democrats can exploit that and keep this Republican Party from finding the political unity and discipline that has been so remarkable in the past. I think that's the strategic challenge the Democrats face.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, moving forward, it's really interesting that Scott Brown, from what I understand, there's plans to primary him already. The Tea Party folks want to primary him already. So there is disgruntlement amongst the Tea Party folks who see that they see themselves as standing for certain principles, and they are frustrated that those principles have been co-opted by large corporations and by institutional politics in Washington. That is an opening, and if the president and the leadership in Congress is smart, they will exploit that moving forward.
Jeffrey, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for your commentary, and let's stay in touch because I really appreciate the way you analyze the moves and, in particularly, the language and framing used by our political leaders.
Always a pleasure, Peter.
Jeffrey Feldman here on the Peter B. Collins Show. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show, sponsored by Cinema Classics, the movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Remember VHS? I've got one. It's a boat anchor over in the corner. Just click on the link on my homepage at peterbcollins.com, and we'll get you free shipping on any order. Just enter PBC in the comments section of their website order form. We continue our post-election analysis of the midterms. And one of the people who inspires me, even in dark days, is the leader of Progressive Democrats of America, Tim Carpenter, a great community organizer and a guy with the inside-outside strategy of trying to move progressive issues and values through the Democratic Party. Hi, Tim.
Peter, hi. Thanks so much for the opportunity today.
Well, it's always good to talk with you. And let's start off on a bright note, because here in California, voters were smart enough to reject corporate candidates, corporate messages, and the corporate power grab of Proposition 23. And with all due respect to Sammy Davis Jr., we get one more spin out of this little tune here, because we're going to be able to say goodbye to the nightmare called the Governator.
Who can take California? Set it on its ear. Stop it in its tracks and take it out of gear. The girly man.
The girly man.
The girly man can.
The girly man can.
The girly man can, because he messes with my mind and makes my world a pain in the you know what.
Well, Tim, a lot of us were very concerned about the repeat of the Schwarzenegger mistake of allowing a Republican with no political experience to buy her way into the governorship here in California. And eBay's Meg Whitman spent $160 million, $140 of it from her own fortune, and came up more than 10 points short. And it really shows the wisdom of Jerry Brown's strategy, which many Democrats were very concerned about and uneasy with, because he didn't go on the air all summer long as she continued to pound 24 hours a day with her television campaign.
No, it's pretty phenomenal, Peter. Being a California native myself and looking back, having been my political teeth in 73, 74 with Jerry when he ran the first time, that was definitely one of the silver linings election night to look at California. Jerry now will go out as the youngest and the oldest, and I think his rope-a-dope and his zenning through the summer and allowing her to pound away is pretty phenomenal, and it's not only everything that you just said, plus we understand out here now, and I don't know, maybe you can confirm for us, that you also won the Attorney General's race, that we won and actually elected a progressive into the Attorney General's race in California. So
I can't quite confirm that. They're still counting ballots, and it's still very close. That and the McNerney-Harmer congressional race, and also the effort to unseat Jim Costa, a conservative Democrat in the Central Valley, that is still unresolved.
Well, those aside, and we'll see where those numbers lead us, but yes, beginning with the Jerry Brown and Barbara Boxer turning it around, and it was phenomenal in California. It was one of the states where PDA was very focused, Progressive Democrats of America. We did a lot of time there. Some of our strongest chapters from Sonoma to Santa Barbara, even into Orange County, were very strong. And another one of our candidates, while he didn't make it, our congressional challenger, Bill Hedrick, out in the 44th against Ken Calvert, did make it, but he was the third highest vote-getter of the challengers. So there was a lot to celebrate, I think, inside the bubble of California on election night. There were certainly a number of other states that we as PDA were also very active in where there was definitely some silver lining. I guess we'd refer to it as the good, the glass half full, but as you know, as we get into this half hour, there was a lot of bad news and some real ugly news on the election front. But again, kudos to California for showing the way, and it's going to be interesting now to watch Jerry as he moves forward. And I think all eyes on the single-payer movement, the Medicare for All movement, are going to be focused now in California to see what Jerry does and what the movement does, where we're probably one of the strongest with the leadership of the California nurses. So I think a lot of us as progressives from across the country will be keeping an eye on California over the course of the next 2 years as we take a few of these speed bumps with the new Congress.
Well, and Jerry Brown, certainly, you know, in a good economy, I think would be right on board with single payer. And I think, you know, he expressed his support for it when he ran for president 15, 20 years ago. But he is taking a very careful approach, and he has made it clear, as he was attacked by the corporate tool for having the support of labor unions, he made it clear that, you know, he doesn't owe the unions, and that he's going to have to make some tough calls. And one of the disappointments about the way Jerry ran this campaign, Tim, was that from the start he said that there will be no new taxes without voter approval. And I think that's a serious mistake, and I understand the calculation that led him to make that pledge, but it ties his hands at a time when the state really has cut expenses and spending almost as far as possible, and yet we still have another $15 billion shortfall looming in the next 12 months. And to close that gap without any new revenues, whether we call them taxes or fees or enhancements, or closing loopholes, is going to be extremely difficult, and it will hit hard on the safety net programs and health care programs as well.
And absolutely. We're going to watch him begin his jiu-jitsu as he made that claim. I remember a former president once said, no raising taxes over my lips, and well, lo and behold, we'll see how creative Jerry gets. He made the calculation to get elected, and now the reality will set in, and we'll see how he moves forward. I think with the combination of him there now as governor and Jones now as your insurance commissioner, I think we might see some creative things going on. But, yeah, it's a real challenge. We'll see what he does. Clearly, Jerry Brown is never one to be moved necessarily by any particular organization or union in particular. But I think what we'll see hopefully over the course of the next year is a newly elected legislature and a political electorate that will work with the governor and build a movement to allow him to move in some of those directions. And it will be very interesting to watch how it happens. Here in Vermont, next door to me in Vermont, the state legislature just voted $300,000 to put together a study on single payer. So a number of states are at work on this, and I think with Jerry and his mind and his leadership, as you said, I remember in 1992 having campaigned for him for president, his commitment on single payer, but he's made it very clear he's going to move at his own pace. So I think we need to continue to build out the movement to create that vehicle for him, to allow him to move in that direction. It's the premise of which a PDA was founded over 7 years ago, to create that movement inside the Democratic Party and outside the Democratic Party to move our legislators, and Jerry will be an interesting one to watch.
Yeah. And Tim, before we dive into the House and the Senate, I'd like to get your comments on the overall nature of this campaign. Because while we are still at war in Iraq, despite the claim that combat has ended, the carnage continues there, and we've expanded our presence in Afghanistan. And PDA has had a strong campaign about health care, not warfare. But in this cycle, neither Democrats nor Republicans raised the war issues virtually at all. And it's really disappointing to me that is not a top priority for the electorate in general, because we know that most people, including many Republicans, are opposed to our current position in Afghanistan and to Obama's escalation there. Yet it wasn't even on the table or even under the tablecloth during this campaign.
Yeah, most of the exit polls, Peter, that we've been looking at, it was ranking anywhere as low as 5, 6, and 7. Anywhere from 7 to 9%, clearly jobs was the overriding issue for most of the electorate. But again, we continue to push on that while it was under the radar to some degree. The races in which we focused, PDA specifically, Jim McGovern out here in Massachusetts in CD3 a month ago,
mm-hmm.
We were very concerned that Jim was in real trouble looking at the polls. While he didn't articulate it to his constituents within the 3rd District, those of us within the Peace and Justice Movement very much mobilized to help him and to ensure that he was reelected, and there was a lot of work under the radar within our movement, a lot of activists outside of Massachusetts who picked up the phone and made calls for Jim. Another example of that would be Raul Grijalva out in Tucson, and I know we'll talk more about that as we move into this, as you said, but here was an example of somebody who's been really leading the fight
mm-hmm.
as the co-chair of the Progressive Caucus to keep this issue out front. And again, the peace and justice community outside of Tucson, as well as inside Tucson, did pick up the phone. But yeah, we were alarmed as you, and I think the hardest thing of all was the one voice that was consistent in speaking out against this war and should have transcended into the peace, and not only in the peace community, but certainly into the TBAG community in regards to some of the issues that TBAG raised with Senator Russ Feingold out in Wisconsin. Here's
yeah.
a case of somebody who was clearly independent of the president in his voting record, one of the few votes, as you know, one of the only votes when it came to the Patriot Act, but one of the few acts that challenged the president on all of the bank bailout, all of the
mm-hmm.
Work make the stimulus even stronger. Issues in which the Tea Party articulated were important to them, and yet it didn't resonate in Wisconsin. But again, coming back to your thesis, yes, it was very disappointing that in the general public that the health care not warfare issue didn't resonate as much as it should have been. We're going to talk more about just the sheer anger and some of the astroturfing that went on and the sheer volumes of money that really drowned out that mic. But there was a lot of work done at the grassroots level. PDA, we just concluded this last month our 11th month in a row vigil, the third Wednesday of every month, in front of our congressional members. We were there the day before the One Nation big rally on the Mall and our lobby day, and we mobilized and delivered over 122 packets, making the connection, as you said, on the military spending and what it's doing to our domestic economy. Mm-hmm. So we have some real challenges, and as you talk about the fiscal crisis California faces and the other states, it's our responsibility now as progressives to make those arguments and to make everybody understand from their communities at the local level to the state level the financial drain that this occupation and the continuing presence in Afghanistan and Iraq are costing us in real dollars. And that's been part of our effort and our campaign with bringing the war dollars home. When you can break it down and get the mic and remind folks that they're spending, in some cases, in some cities, up to $2,000 and $3,000 of their tax dollars on this, what could that money do in their economy? So we have to continue to struggle. It was not clearly the overarching issue. It should have been the issue that ensured Russ Feingold's reelection if we were successful, but it didn't. And I think we can attribute some of it to just simply being drowned out, as we said, and also the progressive community's inabilities to connect. And I think people are just are fatigued. We're into our seventh and eighth year into this struggle, and we still have, needless to say, a lot of work to do.
Yeah. Tim, the other issue that was not completely missing but hugely underplayed is the environmental issues related to climate change, the debacle of the blowout in the Gulf right after Obama had indicated that he was open to expansion of offshore drilling. And here in California, it was an issue in the Senate race because Carly Fiorina maintained a pro-drilling position even after the blowout in the Gulf, and Senator Boxer reminded voters of that quite often. But, you know, mostly the jobs issue trumped any look at climate change or any look at trying to remediate what we saw happen in the Gulf from April through July.
Well, again, looking at California and those of us in the progressive community who remember Jerry Brown when he was a progressive and carried that label very proudly, going all the way back to governorship and having him now back in the governor's mansion or wherever he ends up, the apartment or wherever he ends up, understands that issue. I mean, he was the one I remember as a high school student standing out in front of Diablo Canyon and working to shut down San Onofre Unit 1, who understood way back then the connection in regards to the conservation and the energy challenges we faced back then. And I think as governor now, that's clearly, whether you agree or disagree with Jerry on many issues, that's one we can all come together on. He was way out front and will continue to be in. And I know you, I believe it was Prop 23 where they battled, where the industry tried to repeal some of the good work that Governor Schwarzenegger had actually done on some of this work. So, again, California is showing the way, and I think that that will be another cornerstone of the Brown administration. He understands not just the environmental impact and challenges we face in regards to this, but can make those connections on what it means for a green economy. And as you said, where are we going to get the revenue and move this economy forward? Where are the jobs going to be? And Jerry understands getting many of those unemployed, building some solar panel cells and really getting to work on wind power and so forth, that he can move that agenda forward. And again, you're right, across outside of California, you would think coming off one of the worst environmental disasters that we've ever faced, that it would have been a little more prominent in some of these races. But as we continue this discussion, we'll see what did trump. And again, the ability of some of these folks to raise these issues was simply drowned out with the amount of money that directed many of the discussions that were going on across the country.
Sure, and the billionaires in particular who funded a lot of the independent expenditure campaigns include the Koch brothers, the two billionaires, some of the wealthiest people in America, whose fortune is derived from resource extraction. We saw them launder money through the Chamber of Commerce to try to avoid, you know, the direct backlash of corporate interference in our political campaigns. You know, there was a big pile of money there, a couple of $100 million, that was spent purely to destroy Democratic incumbents.
Yeah, and unfortunately, it's just the tip of the iceberg. We're going to see as the plans have already begun for 2012 and how they're going to apply that. It's a little, I don't know if frightening is quite the word, but if this isn't the clarion call and the wake-up call for anybody who sat on the sidelines this last election cycle to get out there now and get involved with reapportionment coming up now and the amounts of money we saw, we know that we're going to see even more of it. It'll be, you know, the Citizens United on steroids decision and the amount of money that's going to be navigated. I was just the other day talking to many of the activists that have been very active, John Boniface, David Cobb on this issue, and looking at the amounts of money, and as you just said, between the Koch brothers and what Karl Rove was able to put into it, it's overwhelming. And our little effort within PDA and many of our progressives have to understand that we've got to match that money power with the grassroots power. It's the only way. We've got to get active now and think about 2012 in real terms today and tomorrow and get active in our communities. And as we begin this discussion, think of what the political landscape will look like now with reapportionment, with that kind of money in the special interest. And we have a president. We need not forget, when you talk about energy policy, I was with you, Peter, when we were in Denver, when Barack Obama was pushing at that time his clean coal plan, and even today talking about nuclear power and bringing it back to the forefront of the debate. So,
well, and Tim, the frustrating thing is in the Wednesday post-election news conference, the president once again served up a give back, a giveaway to Republicans without getting anything in return, saying that, sure, he's willing to compromise even further on expanding nuclear power in this country. And, you know, I understand the position and his need to make some conciliatory remarks after the losses that the Democrats sustained on Tuesday night. But he didn't put any lines around the limits of his willingness to compromise, whether it's on the extension of the Bush tax cuts or on what he now, you know, calls energy policy. He talked about greenhouse gases, but he doesn't mention climate change anymore. And that was going to be a signature issue of his administration.
And for progressives, as we watched that press conference the day after the election, when he talked about reaching out even more to the business community and traveling more, his overseas trip with business executives with him, it is pretty amazing how tone-deaf he really is when you look at that at a time when he's coming off the election and at any point that he should see the need to come back to his base and understand the importance to not chastise and attack the progressive community as he was doing in the lead-up to the election.
Yeah.
To look in real terms at who these 60 Democrats make up when over 23 of them are the blue dogs and only three are part of the progressive caucus. You would think coming off this election that the president would be reaching out now and working with the progressive community and the progressive caucus to build that. As you know, Peter, when we looked at the health care bill at the end, over 220 amendments that were Republican amendments that the president kept reaching out over to the Republicans to bring them in. And yet here we are after post-election, and what little he was able to get through the health care debate really didn't help at all in this election cycle. Where would we have been had he staked out a real progressive position and come out strongly for single payer and for Medicare for all, mm-hmm. and held that ground, and how many other folks we may have been able to elect, and other seats that could have been saved had he done that. So this president still talking about, quote-unquote, given the political climate of reaching back across the aisle, and I understand the political reality of mouthing that, but the numbers speak for themselves. Mm-hmm. With the 60 Democrats that went down, again, two of the three leaders of the Blue Dog gone, 23 of the Blue Dogs. It's a caucus that's in disarray, and yet he spent 2 years of his first years in the White House bending over and working and turning his back on the 83-plus members of the Progressive Caucus. So as the progressives return back to Congress now, I don't think we're going to see, hopefully, them cutting their sails anymore. We hope now that Raul Grijalva's co-chair of the Progressive Caucus will stake out and hold that. He admitted on election night that he was wrong in not holding out on single payer. They were wrong for not pushing stronger, not just for a withdrawal plan, but for cutting off funding for Afghanistan. So we're setting ourselves up for some real interesting times here in the next 2 years inside the Beltway.
Well, and let's talk about the House. Nancy Pelosi has lost the speakership, and she has tipped that she wants to stay in office and that she wants to remain as the Democratic leader, as minority leader. So that serves up some conflict in the caucus because there were some of these conservatives who wanted to see her go. And there are also some liberals who are disappointed because they felt she compromised too much in pushing through the legislation that she did. But she faces a much different caucus. As you point out, the biggest cost in this election in terms of Democratic losses was to the conservative Democrats, the Blue Dogs, who were recruited by Rahm Emanuel and who won in districts that were typically Republican, that had gone for Bush in the past, and some of which actually supported McCain as they elected a Democrat to Congress. So they were wobbly to begin with, and we saw that that wobbly ripple effect as Pelosi often couldn't corral the votes she needed for more progressive aspects or amendments to these bills. And so while she'll be in the minority, she will have a caucus that's at least a little bit more unified. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the frustrations for many of us in the progressive community is Nancy Pelosi, the Congress member, and Nancy Pelosi, the speaker and the leader of our party. Her record, as you know, being in San Francisco is much better than having to be the leader of the speaker and trying to corral those votes. Now that she's freed up or liberated or surviving the election cycle, she can now hopefully round up a stronger progressive caucus, as we're saying right now, and the numbers will be better. And for some in our progressive circles that are choking back and thinking, oh, gosh, Nancy Pelosi, remember what the alternative is. If it's not Nancy Pelosi, it's Steny Hoyer. So that's kind of a no-brainer. And hopefully now we have a Nancy Pelosi that's liberated in regards to what she can do as a minority leader now to come back with a stronger, as Raul has promised us, a more robust, may I use that word, progressive caucus that is not going to be hopefully rolled over any longer and will hold the line. Hopefully the progressive caucus has learned some lessons over the course of the 2 years from the Blue Dogs in regards to holding out and pushing back and really getting the debate moving in the direction we so desperately needed to move in. So while some in our progressive circles may be a little troubled by the fact that she wanted to come back, there were many that were hoping they might have seen the exit of Nancy Pelosi, but I'm not at all disheartened by that, and I'm encouraged that the co-chairs of the Progressive Caucus, as we said, Raul Grijalva and Lynn Woolsey, have come out and said they're going to support Nancy, because the alternative of a Steny Hoyer is we don't even want to go in that direction. So
I agree.
Again, we start this premise, and as we look at this analysis, PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, was founded 7 years ago because we believed very much that we needed to move this party back to a governing progressive majority. We've learned the hard way now over the course of the last 4 years, simply electing Democrats in the House and simply electing a Democratic president isn't going to get us there. So we've got to talk about in real terms what it means to elect progressive Democrats. And I, for one, didn't lose much sleep Tuesday night when I heard that 23 Blue Dogs had lost their seats. At the end of the day, if we could move 23 Blue Dogs in each election cycle, I think our party would be much stronger. Yes, we're in the minority right now, but we're getting rid of the Dinos, the Democrats in name only. We're getting hopefully back to the real Democrats and the real progressive Democrats. So I'm not by any means disheartened that Nancy's going to be coming back and leading the party now in the other side of the aisle. And I think that hopefully that the Progressive Caucus, as we said, will have learned some lessons and will hold the line now and really do some real inside-outside work in Washington.
Well, and Tim, there are some lessons that can be taken from the unity and the party discipline demonstrated by Republicans when they were in the minority. And to me, the best defense that the Democrats have played in recent history was blocking George W. Bush's attempt to privatize Social Security. That was a definite win for the Democrats. And they need to look at how they did that and come up with defensive strategies that work in unifying the Democrats to prevent the worst of the agenda of John Boehner. And as he tries to placate his Tea Party extremists, he's going to have his hands full. And I believe the Democrats can play some interesting games, if you will, or use some interesting strategies to divide the Republican caucus. And that takes unity of the Democrat minority to pull that off.
Yeah, and we've got a three-dimensional chess game right off as we start into the lame duck session. We're going to replay the whole Bush debate again on the privatization of Social Security. And unfortunately, we have a president who's going to use the Debt Commission report coming out the first week in December to do just that, to move the debate back in that direction. And we have to see that unity. Not only do we have to have the jiu-jitsu and the courage to hold off within the Republican Party, but our own president, when they start talking about privatizing Social Security again, raising the retirement age, and the attacks that we're going to see under this ruse of the debt commission, and how that will play out.
Well, and Tim, we have to insist that the let me put it this way. It's a very regressive Social Security tax, because the FICA tax is capped at just under $100,000. And we could keep Social Security solvent as far as the eye can see if we simply lift that cap by doubling or tripling it, and really spread out the inflow of money to the Social Security Trust Fund, and not just limit it to the first $100,000 of the income of more wealthy people.
No, and as you know, that's been an ongoing debate, and many of the other 30-year-olds have been arguing for some time some of the creative ways we can move this debate off of this whole discussion. And it's going to be a just intense debate here coming up just on that whole question, as you said, Peter, on Social Security. It's imperative that the Progressive Caucus not fold like they did on the single-payer question. We succeeded beginning in Labor Day. Raul Grijalva and Lynn Woolsey wrote a letter to the president challenging him. As I said, we were on the ground as Progressive Democrats the day before the big march on Washington for One Nation as the lobby day, asking our members of the Progressive Caucus to draw a line in the sand and hold to it and not to fold. And Raul admitted, Congressman Grijalva, that they did not do as good a job as they should have done in regards to single payer, and they better hold the line on Social Security. As you said, it's a bogus argument to begin with, and to even be thinking about raising the retirement age at this point in time or even privatizing Social Security, the Progressive Caucus has to show some backbone. Today, I think the numbers, 155 Democrats now have signed the pledge to hold the line on Social Security. Now it's imperative that we work with them, that they do just that. And as you said, the arguments are certainly in our favor, and we need to just hold our line.
The other issue with this deficit commission is that we have to continue to hammer that defense spending was not included. And that's the biggest growth area. It's the biggest cost center. And we've got to bring that under control. And that's inexorably linked to the war in Afghanistan and whatever we plan to do in Iraq. I'm not persuaded that all our troops are coming out of there by the end of next year. And we need to push hard to cut defense spending, because to think that we can balance the budget in this country and really have a government that is fair and serves the interests of the average American without touching defense spending is just bullshit.
No, I mean, Peter, I think you pretty well nailed it on that one. And when we have folks like Jan Jaskinkowski and Andy Stern, the former president of SEIU, on that commission, and we've been raising this argument with them, and yet the report has been leaked for the most part. We know where they're going, and yet that's the white elephant that's in the room. As your listeners know, when you're spending $1 million per soldier on the surge, and you start costing out those numbers until you really tackle the defense budget or the war budget, we're not going to get a handle on it. So that's got to be our offense when they come back with their report, is to really look at where those cuts are. And I'm encouraged by that in looking on where we are and how we have moved that debate. Peter, I mean, Barney Frank, who was under attack out here in Massachusetts, won his congressional seat quite well. Ron Paul, unfortunately, his son is now going to the U.S. Senate. But they understand the need to get a handle on the defense budget.
Now, we cannot impose the sins of the son on the father.
The good news with the son is that he understands, as a libertarian, and the arguments that he's been making, just as his dad did with the 25% commission, that we've got to look at the defense budget. We can cut 25% of the defense budget, or as we're saying today, the war budget tomorrow, without any severe impact. We can start talking about shutting down on the bases around the country, not just getting out of Afghanistan and Iraq as promised by the president, but to really get on with cutting and redirecting that military spending in a meaningful way. And we can drive this deficit down very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Tim, with the exiting of some of these House blue dogs that were nominally Democrats, did we have any gains of new progressives elected in this cycle?
Well, nobody that stepped up and said, I am. We might have a few closet, hopefully, that'll come out. The biggest fight for us, as I said when we began the discussion in PDA, was Bill Hedrick out there in California. He was the one we thought we could get the breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
We began this election cycle in the hopes that we would be adding and playing much more offense, but unfortunately the reality was at the end of the day we were playing way too much defense, and even that we weren't as successful as we were. But as we said when we started the discussion today, both Jim McGovern and Raul Grijalva did survive, and those were two of the stalwarts, the heroes of the progressive community.
Mm-hmm.
There was late-hour concern about Dennis Kucinich. There always is with Dennis in Ohio, given what happened in Ohio with Strickland going down and most of the Democrats going down. But Dennis survived with 54% of the vote. So, again, there's good news there for the progressive community. But, no, we didn't get the gains we needed, and that's the work that we have to be real about. And I've been having this discussion with you, Peter, all the way back to when we were together in Denver. We have to start thinking of these elections not 6 weeks or 6 months out, but every day between now and the election in 2012, we should, as a progressive community, be focused on these upcoming races with reapportionment. The work that we do as progressives has to be an electoral focus, as we said, an inside and an outside piece. We've got to grow those numbers, and we've got to make the progressives that are in the caucus stronger. The reality is we talk here tonight and we look back, whether it be the single-payer fight or the cutting off spending on the war, we oftentimes start out with 60 or 70 members of the Progressive Caucus, and unfortunately at the end of the day, it's the 8 or 9 that we can really count on. So part of our strategy, and I think the lesson we have to learn as progressives, is to get out there and shore up our friends as much as we want to advance and elect more Democrats, progressive Democrats. We've got work to do just to make sure that we don't revisit what happened in CD3 out here in Worcester, Massachusetts, right in Tucson, Arizona, that some of our best friends aren't under attack. And it was just 2 years ago that Lynn Woolsey mm-hmm. out there in Northern California and Dennis had another strong challenge that he faced. So we have twofold. We've got to advance and we've got to shore up our members. But I, looking at the horizon tonight and all the new members that are coming in, I don't see the next Dennis Kucinich or Barbara Lee out there yet. But hopefully they'll emerge. We didn't know, and unfortunately we lost Grayson out in Florida this last cycle. But
yeah.
when he was elected, we didn't certainly know that night what a strong voice he was going to be in the progressive. So hopefully mm-hmm. There'll be some more out there. We just don't know yet.
Tim, finally, I want to talk about the Senate races in the context of the White House political operation. Because Axelrod and his team were seen as golden boys and girls because of the remarkable election of Barack Obama in 2008. But they fumbled the ball in a lot of ways. One, by raiding the Senate for cabinet appointees, and then trying to prop up the temporary senators in the face of the midterm elections here. Even without the Tea Party and the economic mess, these were difficult tasks to take on. And so, by backing Blanche Lincoln through her primary challenge, by sticking with Arlen Specter in that stinky deal with the devil, we saw two seats that might have stayed Democrat fall into Republican hands. And I'm not going to miss Blanche Lincoln, but I don't lick my chops because this guy Boozman is, another one of those right-wing Republicans. At the same time, the White House miscalculated, I think, Lincoln's chances of surviving and the need for these conservative Democrats in the United States Senate. Likewise, they miscalculated on Giannoulias in their own state of Illinois, another weak candidate along the lines of Martha Coakley in your home state of Massachusetts. And just finally, to reiterate, by staying with Specter through the primary, they weakened Joe Sestak, who came within 2 points of,
yeah.
of putting a real Democrat in that seat.
And the other thing, too, is that we look back on election night, think if the teabaggers hadn't been there, there's even more Senate seats if they had filed a stronger candidate. I'm convinced that Harry Reid may not have pulled it out if he had a real candidate that ran against him out in Nevada. So
yeah.
This whole debate on the Senate is going to go around and around. But I think in the closing couple minutes we have together is to just look at not only did they fumble it, but I'm grateful that Michelle Obama got out to Wisconsin, but way too late. Why weren't more resources mobilized from the White House for one of our progressive heroes? Again, so much energy to keep some of these weak or dino Democrats viable through Election Day. And yet, I never saw the clarion call that we should have had for Russ Feingold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, I want to, end where we began. Here is somebody who, without a doubt, of all of the ones that we lost on election night, it reminds me of 1980 when we lost George McGovern and Frank Church and John Culver and Birchbaugh, when we lost some real lions of the Senate. And to lose Russ Feingold and not to see the White House do even more to try to save it, I know Wisconsin is not the state some of us perceive it to be, having been on the ground out there in the last couple of months to watch some of that demise. But the fact that we didn't do more as a progressive movement, the fact that many of our allies weren't out there sooner, and the White House wasn't mobilized to save Russ Feingold, and we know why. In regards to the White House, I mean, here's a senator who had the courage to challenge the president in regards to the banking reform, really challenged the president to come up with more monies for the stimulus, with the only vote, as you know, on the Patriot Act, the one that led the fight in the Senate when the House was trying to get the debate moving on Iraq and Afghanistan. So when we look at the Senate and the pluses, the gains, the losses, the fumbles, the misses, this is the one that's going to follow us for decades. To have lost Russ Feingold and this political climate is pretty horrific. And we as a progressive community also, not just to fix the blame outside of our own community, but inside the progressive community, why weren't we better organized as a progressive community? I wish that we had more resources as PD and we could have put more there. I wish that Move On had been there sooner, and I just wish as a movement as a whole we had done a whole lot more. So when we look at the Senate race, that's the one tonight that's just really hard, and I hope that people in their own voices drop a note to Russ and thank him.
Yeah. Well, and Tim, I am one of these people who's not afraid to pipe up at this point. I'd like to see Russ Feingold explore a run for president. And I believe that Barack Obama needs and deserves a progressive challenger, and that we should not just be polite and say that he is entitled to a second term. If he can persuade voters that he deserves a second term, I'm not against that. But there are so many issues where he has not just disappointed me, but failed to lead, failed to provide a president who really would deliver on repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's a no-brainer. That one should have already been achieved. And it's now going to get lost in this shuffle. And I believe that Obama certainly deserves the opportunity to run for re-election, but that for a robust and active Democratic Party, that a progressive challenger would be a very healthy development.
Well, as you know, Peter, we were founded, PDO, on the premise that a strong primary makes us stronger as a party and makes our incumbents and our campaigns and our challengers so much stronger. We began way back in the day when Rahm Emanuel was handpicking and jamming a lot of candidates down our throat. We stuck with Christine Sigalas back in 06 because we believed that she was a stronger candidate, and that was an important race, and we were forced with Tammy Duckworth, and now we don't even hold that seat anymore, or we never really got that seat as Democrats. We were the ones who were out front early challenging Al Wynn, a corporate, centrist, pro-war Democrat, early with Don Edwards, and while Donna lost, we came back and won it on the second go-around. We, like you, agree very much that the primary challengers are, we as a party, are much stronger. While some people aren't ready yet to even think about who that person might be to challenge President Obama in the primaries, I'm with you. I think we need that rigorous debate. So if it's just a matter at this point in time of talking about putting together slates of uncommitted delegates under a health care, not warfare banner, I think we need to have that discussion. I agree with you totally. I think we need to go back and reread our history and look at what Al Lowenstein accomplished in his Dump Johnson movement. Again, a quixotic effort when it began, and at the end of the day, toppled an incumbent president. And I think we're certainly not going to talk about defeating Barack Obama right now with 2 years to go, but we certainly need to talk about making him a stronger president and building that movement. That's what we've been doing from the beginning of this whole cycle of the Obama administration. As you know, Peter, we came to Obama very late as Progressive Democrats of America. We didn't even endorse him. He was the third one when we got done with the endorsement. We were we barely made it onto the caboose in Denver when it was time to nominate him. We have no illusions. He's not a progressive. But what we are hopeful for and continue to have hope and will continue to organize and mobilize is that we can move him and we can create a movement just as we did with FDR way back when, and move him to become that president. And what other better way to do that than to start that discussion now and challenging him with 2 years to go on what a reelection campaign should be, and to stop this whole discussion of moving progressive issues off of the table and having that discussion as a party. And what is the this administration going to do over the course of the next 2 years to do that? And we want to be part of that discussion. As PDA, we have members in Iowa and New Hampshire already that are having that discussion. We're looking at the filing on deadline. So as a run-up to that, many of the states now in 2011 will be having their state Democratic meetings. So it'll be imperative that we pass resolutions at that level to challenge them, just as California did on Afghanistan, just as California did on single payer. California's been out front on these issues at the grassroots level and been trying to move this president, and we want to, as PDA, be part of that effort, not only in California but across the country, to do just that.
Tim Carpenter, Progressive Democrats of America. Visit their website, pdamerica.org. Thank you, Tim.
Peter, thanks so much.
I'm heading off into the sunset, taking a little vacation. Our next podcast will hit your desktop just before Thanksgiving. Drop me an email, peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.
Thank you, Tim.
Peter, fastest 20 minutes in radio. Thanks so much.
Hey, it's great to talk to you and conspire with you, and I'll see you when you come out here, okay?
Yeah, definitely. We'll be in touch. I really want to talk really seriously about how we move all of this forward and think creatively and outside the box some more.
Real
Thank
good.
You, Peter.
You bet, Tim. Have
see
a good day.
Bye. Bye-bye now.